Hi, and welcome to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio, CFRO in Vancouver, unceded Coast Salish Territories, Canada. Today's Friday, June 15th, 2012. I am your host, Alon Cohen, and I'm joined by my co-host, Addison Cole.
Hello.
And Alyssa Ray, who's not in the room right now.
She'll be here.
We're also joined today by two former UBC students and current animal activists in charge of a speaker series that happened at UBC, Darren Chang and Viera Jureva. They're just now coming in, actually. So Animal Voices is Vancouver's and Western Canada's only animal advocacy and vegan radio program, bringing you all the animal and vegan-related news, events, interviews, lifestyle, and commentary you need to keep up to date on what's happening both locally and internationally. We at Animal Voices encourage a movement toward a world in which animals, both human and non-human, are treated with compassion and care. We strive to expose all the complicated relationships we share with all the critters of this planet and wish that all animals be able to flourish their full potential. This program can be heard every Friday from noon to 1 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and is also streamed live at coopradio.org. and available on iTunes and animalvoices.org after airing. On today's show, we chat with former University of British Columbia students about the university's attempt to appropriate a radical speaker series on animals that challenges the university's governance on animals in research at the university. We also talk to Dr. Gary Steiner, John Howard Harris Professor of Philosophy at Bucknell University, about his forthcoming book, Animals and the Limits of Postmodernism. Darren and Viera are two former UBC students who were part of the organizing collective that created the speaker series, bringing the collective together, non-human animals, humans, and practice at the university, which he's spoken about at length and promoted at the show, as it's been happening throughout the past year at the University of British Columbia. The series initiated meaningful interdisciplinary scholarly deliberation about the use of non-human animals in university teaching and research. It brought together scholars from the humanities, social sciences, and sciences who otherwise have scant occasion to interact. UBC was impressed, but was also, it seemed to be, scared that their series had the potential to fundamentally question and potentially alter their practices of animal testing. UBC has a bad reputation of being extremely opaque when it comes to animal testing, and saw the series as an attempt to prove their openness. Viera and Darren are not happy, initially calling the university out in the university student newspaper. However, the UBC administration is at it again, and today we'll be talking about what exactly they're doing in order to co-opt this radical potential of the series. Later in the show, we talk to Dr. Gary Steiner about his work in the philosophy of animal ethics and rights. Dr. Steiner believes that the philosophers such as Peter Singer, Jeremy Bentham, and Tom Regan, philosophers both old and current, who are seen as kind of the dominant modern figures of the animal rights movement, he sees them as ultimately failing to truly support animals and their plight as they remain caught within a humanist framework. In response to the failures of humanism, a number of writers who could be called postmodernism who could be called postmodernists have actually taken up the cause of animals. But Dr. Steiner believes that they as well, the postmodernists, are not very helpful either when it comes to animals. So in this episode, we'll be discussing what is wrong with the current model of humanist philosophy, why postmodernism is not the way to fight for animals, and what a truly non-anthropocentric humanism would look like. So you're listening to the Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 Co-op Radio, CFRO. And let's jump right towards Allison with her cookbook review.
Hey there. So touted as the world's most approachable plant-based cookbook, I've had the opportunity over the last few months to test almost a dozen recipes from Lindsay S. Nixon's recent softcover collection called The Happy Herbivore, over 150 delicious, fat-free, and low-fat vegan recipes. Part of what drew me to try out this book was the author's already popular presence on the internet as she composes a neat recipe blog site called The Happy Herbivore. herbivore. And also, I love any book that boasts a plethora of beautiful full-color photos for most of the recipes in an easy-to-read and very accessible layout, as this book does. Another enticing draw to this book is the angle of being low-fat and even fat-free, for we are certainly bestowed with many vegan recipe books that offer multitudes of rich and fattening foods that don't necessarily count the calories nor the fat content when their preparation is executed. Vegan cupcakes take over the world, anyone? Sure, to be fair, there are also loads of vegan recipe books that offer many healthful recipes, and that's also what you're likely to get when eating a fruit and veggie plant-based diet, one would think, but this book extends this theme to the breadth of being uber healthy for those watching their fat intakes, and definitely takes the extra steps to make deliberate low-fat or no-fat substitutions for certain ingredients that would most commonly be used. For example, I've made a lot of the sweet recipes in this book, such as the muffins, cookies, and brownies. And while the complete absence of margarine or oil may be noticeable in the text of the recipe copy, I can assure you that in taste it's most triumphantly undetectable. Instead of the typical fats that might be used in these recipes, Lindsay appropriates applesauce, and whereas refined flours and refined sugars are most used, we use whole wheat flours and unrefined raw sugar instead in these recipes, making for some very healthy desserts. The delicious chocolate chip cookies, for example, only have 0.7 grams of fat each at 61 calories per cookie. Knowing that might make you want to eat more cookies, but at least they're pretty good for you. And of course, not only are all of these recipes good for your body, but they are also good for the bodies of all the animals you are saving by using the ingredients in this book to make delightful recipes rather than using decomposing corpses and secretions of our fellow creatures. I like cookbooks that give you some preparatory information at the beginning to get you started and also share with you the tricks and techniques of the author and how they prep their kitchen. This book exhibits a nice getting started section that gives a list of staple pantry, refrigerator, freezer items, and spices to have on hand for the recipes in this book. Lindsay makes good use of ingredients such as non-dairy milks, quinoa, nutritional yeast, dried spices, and tofu in her recipes. I should also note that each recipe sports a legend of symbols at the top, which represent whether it is quick, fat-free, gluten-free, soy-free, kid-friendly, and or omni-friendly, the latter representing whether or not the recipe was a favorite by the meat eaters among the original taste testers for the book, which is always useful to know. Each recipe also includes a complete nutritional profile, which again is handy and helpful to have if you want to know exactly how many calories and grams of protein, etc., you are putting into yourself. The 175 recipes in this book are broken into categories including breakfast and brunch, muffins and breads, quick one-pot dinners, pasta and casseroles, and desserts, to name some of them. And you will find recipes in here with such tantalizing titles as Nuevos Rancheros, chocolate zucchini muffins, Hawaiian chickpea teriyaki, spicy sausage and penne, and carrot cake cupcakes. As fancy as some of these foods may sound, you will also find extremely simple recipes like the salty dog salad, which makes use of two simple ingredients, kale and salt. So for the newbies in cooking among you, this is a great starter book to get your fingers wet with a variety of easy-to-make recipes with simple directions. Now, as for how the recipes turned out that I made, I've been really enjoying making all of the muffin recipes out of this book, which are all really fast and simple to make, and they turn out great. So for the Animal Voices crew, which actually only consists of Alyssa, who's in the studio today, I made us the Aztec corn soup, the five spice harmony bowl, the chai oatmeal cookies, and the ranch dip with veggies. And I know Alyssa certainly has some differing opinions than me, which is actually always good to hear because it's not just me that will be reading the book. So I say that it's a great book for newbies because the recipes are really simple. What does Alyssa say?
They may be simple, but I don't think that they are tasty enough or show a mastery of food. I don't know. The flavors just seem kind of undeveloped and very, very simple. I found it to be pretty bland and just stuff that I would just kind of throw together at home, and I was surprised that it was in a cookbook, and that's a really bad review, but sorry.
Well, I really tried to make like a variety of recipes that I thought you would like too, because I know you're really into like the healthier,
no,
you know.
Not.
grains and greens and veggies and that. So I made for you the five spice harmony bowl, which is actually
that was my favorite.
Chinese five spice with sweet potatoes. I thought that part was good. Just over a simple bed of wild rice, over a simple bed of mixed greens. Really healthy, you've got to admit.
Yeah.
And I'm really surprised you didn't like the chai oatmeal cookies. I really liked them.
I was looking forward to it. I love chai flavored anything. I love those spices, but the flavors were just kind of, or the cookies were just kind of like oatmeal blobs, and I don't know.
I thought they were really yummy. Anyways,
maybe if they were like fresh Indian spices, like whole,
straight
like
from
grated
India. I should have got some when I was there.
Yeah.
Well, that is our review, and I do recommend that you do try out the book, at least just for the reading, the beautiful photos, and the muffin recipes are all really good, and especially for people who are new to cooking. And I do have our upcoming events right now. On Sunday, June the 17th, from noon till 2 p.m., there will be a book signing with Wayne Pacelli. He is the president and CEO of the Humane Society of the United States, and he'll be doing this book signing at Black Bond Books at Book Warehouse at 632 West Broadway in Vancouver. I don't know if you guys have heard of this. It was only announced this week, and I'm surprised because he's a really big person in the animal rights community. He's written a book called The Bond, Our Kinship with Animals, Our Call to Defend Them, which is certainly on, it's been on my reading list for a while, and I actually did see him speak on this topic of the book last year in Portland. I really do recommend going to this talk, especially if you haven't seen him before, and it's free. It's here in Vancouver at this book signing and talk. Mr. Pacelli will share how he has put his 25 years of work experience and hopes into this book and his vision of a better world for us all. So once again, that's this Sunday, June 17th from 12 to 2 p.m. at Black Bond Books at Book Warehouse at 632 West Broadway in Vancouver, a very unique opportunity for us Vancouverites. On Tuesday, June the 19th at 8:30 a.m., there will be a rally for the Whistler Sled Dogs. This is taking place at the North Vancouver Courthouse at 200 East 23rd Street in North Vancouver. The notorious Whistler Sled Dog animal cruelty case, which I'm sure you've all heard about, is happening in the North Vancouver Provincial Court, and the next appearance for Robert Fawcett, that's the man who killed the 100 sled dogs, is scheduled for June 19th at 9:30 a.m. For those who want to attend this rally, this is your chance to let the government know that you want animal abusers punished and put into jail, and that cases like this should be taken seriously. It's also a chance to show the rest of the world that Canadians stand up against animal abusers and that we have not forgotten about the lives violently lost. The rally attendees will be there an hour before the trial starts so that they can be present for Robert Fawcett's arrival, and everyone's invited to attend that. There may be updates and changes to this event, so please check back regularly. You can bring your own signs and banners as well. And where you can check back where this event is posted is at meetup.com/animal-rights-advocacy. On Monday, June 25th from 6 to 8 p.m., there will be a banned shark fin rally at the Burnaby City Council meeting. This is also a topic that's been hot in the news lately, if you've been actually listening to our news on Animal Voices. So this is happening at the Burnaby City Hall at 4949 Canada Way in Burnaby. The Vancouver Animal Defense League is joining the fight to save our fin friends. They want to see shark fins banned not only in Vancouver, but are pushing for a simultaneous ban in Burnaby, Richmond, and Vancouver. They want the sale, possession, and trade of shark fins to be banned outright in all three cities. On June 25th, they will be appearing before the City Council of Burnaby to speak for the sharks. Vancouver activist and past Animal Voices radio show host Anthony Marr will be speaking, and he has 10 minutes to convince the city why this ban should be put into place. The meeting fits 90 people, the meeting room that is, and Vancouver Animal Defense League wants to make sure that they're standing room only, so this is your official invitation to attend. And as of a few days ago, there were already 19 people RSVP'd on the part of representing the sharks to be attending so far. They will be arriving at City Hall an hour before the meeting starts to rally for the sharks. Bring your signs and banners. This demo is one of the most important we will see all year. Watch for the Richmond rally coming soon. And if you want information about this event, you can email Vancouver Animal Defense League at live.ca. And that's all the time we have for events for this week. If you have an animal-friendly event that you would like to see on the show, or see aired on the show, please email us the details at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com, or you can also post it on our Facebook page, which is Animal Voices Vancouver.
Tune in Thursday nights for Fruit Salad from 7 to 8 p.m.
Tune in to Fruit Salad. Tune in Thursday nights for Fruit Salad.
Check out Fruit Salad Thursday nights from 7 to 8 p.m. on 102.7 FM, highlighting queer, trans, lesbian, gay organizations, writers, performers, musicians, families, pink world news, and much, much more. Fresh fruit, every show.
Tune in.
Hey there, so you're listening to the Vancouver Animal Voices Radio Show here on 102.7 FM CFRO, Vancouver Cooperative Radio. So I'm here in the station with Darren. If you could both of you say hi so we can check your...
Hello.
Hey.
Hey there.
And also Viara.
Hi.
So Darren and Viara, two former UBC students, part of the organizing collective that created the speaker series entitled Bringing the Collective Together, Non-Human Animals, Humans, and Practice at the University. I spoke about the series a bit at the introduction. So what it was a speaker series at the University of British Columbia that brought together both scholars from the humanities, social sciences, and sciences to talk about questions of non-human life and governance and practice at the university, and to kind of challenge the business as usual model at the university. So we're here to talk about, with Darren and Viara as part of the organizing team, about kind of UBC's process, the administration's process in all of this. So of course the university isn't a monolithic entity. So what was the administration's reaction to the series? When I think of the UBC administration, I'm thinking of course of John Hepburn, who's the Vice President of Research and International, and Helen Burt, who's the Associate Vice President of Research and International.
When we put together the series originally, that was about last spring when we were thinking up of all the concepts and starting to think of who we might want to invite. We actually initially invited John Hepburn to be a moderator at least one of the panels that we held, and he denied his attendance, and then afterwards we at least invited him to attend any of the other panels if he wanted to, and he denied that as well. So the series was on the administration's radar right off the bat, pretty much from about a year ago. And we really didn't hear anything from them until it actually started to happen. The first event was at the end of October, and the other events were earlier on in 2012. And that is when we began to sort of see them attempt to really co-opt our series, I think we believe. So, yes.
So it was also right at the beginning of October, UBC also established a website called animalresearch.ubc.ca. It has actually been advertising the series on this website. How do you feel was the motivation, or what do you think exactly the processes behind this establishment of the website at the coincidental moment in which the speaker series actually began at UBC?
Well, I guess basically it's not difficult to see that the website is UBC's propaganda website to justify the use of animal research, and by advertising our series on their website, they're in a sense saying that, you know, look, UBC is openly engaging the public through these mini lecture series, and in that sense the university is critical of its own animal research, and that only further justifies their use of animals.
So if we can jump forward a bit to February, Public Affairs released a report entitled Animals in Research with four articles from individuals, with John Hepburn actually kind of framed as the introducer or kind of the facilitator of these discussions. And it had articles from Bill Milson, who's the head of the zoology department, a professor of medical genetics, David Fraser, who's the animal welfare program, who's in the animal welfare program, and Jodi Kostrakana, who's the only social scientist in these articles. She's actually a professor of critical animal studies. So as organizers, did Public Affairs approach you regarding this report, and how do you feel about its publication in relation to the speaker series? Do you feel, like you said, Darren, that it constitutes the administration's attempt to appropriate the challenging critique that the series poses towards the university?
Yeah, definitely. I think by demonstrating how different scholars are coming together to debate this issue on animal research on their website, they're using it to legitimize their current practices and legitimize the status quo on campus. Whereas for us, the reason why we started this series was precisely because there was no dialogue whatsoever in the beginning, and no scholars were really getting together to talk about these issues. So, Vier, anything to add?
The other thing that I think we should notice that when UBC Reports published this piece, they also distinctly linked to our series. Our series was a part of the Green College series that are held every year, and Public Affairs chose to not only hold these scholars, many of which were part of our series, but they also chose to link directly to our speaker series, sort of making it appear as if this was a part of that.
So it seems that there were two kind of implications from this. On the one hand, it seemed that UBC, the PR geniuses that are working there, have fantastically spun the series to make it seem like part of UBC's mission to make itself more transparent. And on the other hand, by putting Hepburn, of course, as kind of the facilitator of this, the fact that, of course, you guys invited Hepburn to speak, but he denied it, and then facilitating these kind of discussion series on the forum, it makes it almost seem that he is the organizer, in a sense, making the real organizers, the undergraduate students, and the professors invisible, right?
Exactly.
Viera, can I just get you to move right in front of the mic, please? You're not speaking in the mic.
Sorry.
Thank you. Is that better? Oh, that's much better. Thank you.
Awesome.
Sorry.
So as a response to the administration's attempt to co-opt the series, you guys, of course, wrote in the student newspaper, which is called the UBC, a response article calling out the administration. And you said that the framing gives the impression that the UBC administration has coordinated an ongoing academic dialogue to evolve our thinking and practices, and that Green College series falls under the auspices of the centralized undertaking. This is not the case. Our aim is not to affirm UBC as a place of openness to legitimate standing practices. What was Public Affairs' reaction to the letter that was published in the student newspaper?
Well, Public Affairs contacted us and asked us to meet with them. And a few of the students and one of the professors involved in working on this speaker series actually went off and met with Public Affairs. At this time, they were highly apologetic and really acted as if this was all coincidental, that they had an ongoing mandate to discuss animal research on campus.
So what exactly were they apologetic about?
They were mostly apologetic about sort of making it appear as if they were having these particular scholars featured on their website in conjunction to our series. And then they really tried to sort of back out of that apology. At the same time, they said that they had been in contact with many of those scholars prior to our speaker series even existing. So they said that they had already established a relationship with Bill Milsom. And really, out of the scholars that were featured in that particular piece, the only new person that they had sort of discovered through our series was Jody Castricano. So in a sense, they were apologetic that we felt that they had sort of co-opted our series. But at the same time, they were saying that we had really misunderstood their intentions.
So what exactly did they try to do to remedy the situation?
What they did was they offered us a space within UBC Reports, which is their monthly publication that the UBC Public Affairs publishes. So they offered us a space in UBC Reports to basically criticize Public Affairs if we want to. It's really open-ended. They basically said we could write whatever we want and they would publish it.
That really shocks me, because that's a really PR-heavy publication. They actually said, yeah, you can write whatever you want and criticize us. It would be sort of like an editorial, like letter to the editor type thing, where you do want to publish opposing views that might not make UBC look good.
Well, it's very interesting that you asked that, because our original impression, and I think their original offer to us, was to publish whatever you write as an independent article. But as it turns out, in the end, it did turn into more of an opinion piece, like just an opinion
letter.
Has
it been published?
Yes, it's been published.
Oh, okay.
It could be posted online on your links.
Definitely. So, of course, a lot of the apology was based on making the organizers invisible. So they wanted to highlight the organizers by allowing them to write this piece in the UBC reports. And, of course, if we flash forward a couple of months...
I also just want to quickly point out that by giving us the opportunity to write this letter, they are basically asking us to apologize for them on their behalf instead of taking responsibility as an organization that is specifically meant to deal with the public. So instead of apologizing publicly to us and to the general public on misinforming them, what they did was they got us to, they gave us this opportunity to write this letter. So when
How
it gets published,
them?
It appears
and,
as if
they've
done
write,
good deeds.
They didn't write a response to your article that you had published, I presume.
In the UBC?
Yeah.
No, they didn't. They just invited us over to their offices to
How
talk
convenient.
To us.
Okay,
yes.
So when we forward, flash forward a quote, of course, the UBC reports is being published. So what exactly was the content of the reflection piece that was published in this UBC administration's PR piece?
Well, we chose to sort of not take the space to apologize on their behalf. We felt that we had really said whatever we wanted to say in regards to the February piece, when we wrote that initial article in the UBC newspaper, the student newspaper. So instead, we took the space to really reflect upon the series, what we felt was, what we felt the series had accomplished. And really, that's kind of the content of the piece that's up on their website right now, raising some critical questions. We tried to criticize John Hepburn and his attempted involvement in the series as well.
Great. So, of course, after you sent this piece to the administration for the UBC report, what exactly happened?
So the administration pretty much told us that we would be writing an independent article. If you go online to the UBC reports article, or newspaper rather, you scroll through and there's independent articles, and we were made to believe that ours would be a part of that. Instead, it's made to appear as a letter to the editor type thing, and it's slotted at the very end. I think the title was changed from something.
Yeah, so the original title of our article, which that was back when we assumed it was going to be published as an article, it was called Series Conveners Question Use of Animals. But when it did get published in the UBC reports, then main heading became In Their Own Words. And our title of the article became like more of a subheading.
Yeah, so it became an opinion piece. So it's important to note that, of course, it became transformed from a sense in which there was a validity and credibility to the writers to merely one more opinion piece in their series of letters, right?
Right, and that is one thing that they've done with our piece, was to use it to start this letter submission thing that they're doing for the month of June, which all members of the public or any scholars on campus can submit their own letters to UBC Public Affairs, which would be published online.
Right, and I think the important thing to note about this is that when you go onto their website, if you go and act as if you're going to submit a piece, there's a very distinct disclaimer that says we will edit we reserve the right to edit whatever you submit to us. We will not necessarily publish what you submit. If there's a bunch of things in a similar tone, we will only publish one or two of those things. So in a sense, they're acting as if they're opening this up to comments. They're acting as if they're trying to create engagement, but in reality, they're editing all of the submissions and they're not really allowing everybody to post whatever they want to say. If you have 10 people submitting a piece against animal research and one person submitting a piece for animal research, they will publish one of each and say, oh, well, we're trying to represent both sides. But if anybody is looking at those comments, they're unable to get a sense of what the public is really thinking.
To be fair, they do have that prerogative. It is their publication, right?
Of course. But it is, I think, interesting to note that this is how they're choosing to structure it. Also, UBC Reports is going to be publishing three of their own pieces on animal research. I think one of them is up right now. One is going up in July and one is going up in September. And it's also interesting to note that commentary or letter submission is not available for any of those pieces, just for the thing that we wrote.
Yeah, and only in the month of June. It ends at the end of this month. I mean, we do encourage the listeners to go check it out and submit their own opinions if they want to. But Yes, it ends the end of this month.
Definitely. So of course, this whole battle is, you know, yet from being over. Last Friday, The Current on CBC with Anna Marie Tremonti had a report on animal research. And Helen Burt, who, like I said, was the vice president of international, was interviewed, and she said that when asked about the question of transparency and how they make themselves accountable, she said that UBC has had a public dialogue series at one of our colleges where we have discussed and debated with members of the public and researchers in an open, respectful discourse about the kinds of work going on at UBC, the goals and regulation that we are using. So we see continuously them using the speaker series as a way to justify their own practices and to maintain the fact that they are being transparent. Very quickly, given that the fact that this is far from over and this is continuing, what are your plans for the future, and do you have any final thoughts about this whole process as it currently stands?
Well, I think a group of students are looking to start up a blog online, and this would be more or less of a counter-media thing to just point out how the UBC Public Affairs is manipulating whatever information that we submit to them or whatever it is that they publish and on their animal research website. And
there is also a club at UBC, a student club, so if any of you are UBC students, you're welcome to look for that and join that.
And what is that club called?
Activists for Animals. You can find them on Facebook.
Or activistsforanimals.ubc@gmail.com is our email.
Great. Well, thanks so much, you guys. And of course, this whole process really shows and demonstrates to us what it means when we try to reform the institution from the inside, and the way that these power dynamics really play out to usurp and co-opt any kind of forms of radical critique and change that may already happen. So thanks so much, you guys.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
You're listening to Animal Voices, of course. My name is Alyssa, and I just have some news items for you that happened over the last week. Big news was that a humpback whale was found beached in White Rock. That was June 12th. The whale was found to be severely underweight and had many injuries, including scarring and sores on the tail. And also the mouth of the humpback was found to be covered in fish netting. And the whale appears to have been lacerated by the line, like, a lot. And the Vancouver Aquarium said that the whale had likely to have been entangled in that fishing line for weeks or perhaps months, judging by the low weight and scarring. The whale probably died on the beach, it was reported. And the body has now been moved away from the beach. It's about 9 meters long. I'm not sure where it'll end up in the end, but it's not there anymore. And there was some media outlets that were reporting that the fishing line was not from Canada, as if to, I don't know, point the finger to another country. But of course, Canada uses fishing line and netting, and there's tons of bycatch and non-target animals, so to speak, that are injured and killed by these lines all the time. It doesn't really matter where they're from. It's just a big, huge problem with the fishing industry. Allison, you had some...
This was a huge story this week, the biggest animal-related story of the week, which is why we're covering it. And I was just really surprised and I just sort of shocked as to how deeply this really seemed to affect our local community, especially the people that were down at the beach. There's pictures on the front pages of our local newspapers of, you know, people encircled around the whale with, they had put flowers on the whale, and people were crying apparently, and we were just really moved and touched about, you know, just seeing the life taken out of this majestic creature that they had such a short time to connect with, but yet still made that human to non-human animal connection that we often make usually with our pet dogs or cats, companion animals, but not so much with whales or other animals. So I really just hope that this will plant a seed in people's mind that all life should be respected, not, as I posted on my Facebook, not just that of humans and whales, but all life, just respect life. And I just really hope that maybe this will allow people to think about connecting with other animals and regarding and having respect for other life.
Thank you. Yeah. And another sad local news. 2 weeks ago, about it was reported that a cat killer was on the loose in Maple Ridge. There was over the bodies of about 15 cats were found. That's the town that I was from, so that one hit me. So the bodies of cats were found terribly mutilated and often just severed, like, completely in half. So they were just thinking terrible. Some sort of sick person was out there doing this to the animals, and also that some were reported dead in Langley. Just this morning, the SPCA reported that at least some of the recent deaths were the result of a non-human animal predator attack. Mm-hmm. They're not sure what kind of animal, and the deaths before that might have still been a human perpetrator. So, again, a reminder to keep cats in safe enclosures. I think that should always be the case. But, I just have a couple other quick things. Colombia's capital city, Bogota, is repurposing their bullfight ring into a culture and education center. The closing of the venue was based on a Colombian constitutional court ruling, which stated that activities involving entertainment and cultural expression with animals may be practiced, provided the animals receive special protection against suffering and pain during the course of the activities. The city government had ordered Bogota's bullfighting corporation to abandon animal cruelty, including the death of the bull. The corporation unsurprisingly refused to do so. The venue is now going to be put to use, to great use, actually. It'll host national writers and poets presentations to public school students. So I love seeing venues of death be repurposed. So I'm happy to share that story today. And that's all the time I have for headlines. Now on to our feature interview.
So today we have with us Dr. Gary Steiner. He's a John Howard Harris Professor of Philosophy at Bucknell University. He's written multiple books about non-human animals within philosophy and about community relations with them. And he currently has a new book that's come out this year, which is entitled Animals and the Limits of Postmodernism. So hi there.
Hi.
So thinking about animals in the philosophic tradition has, of course, had a very long history. It goes all the way back to the Greeks. And many, of course, even philosophers such as Peter Singer, who people claim to be the father of modern animal rights movement. But you claim that for Peter Singer, the capacity to suffer is that which we share with animals. However, this question of suffering goes all the way back to Jeremy Bentham. So what was exactly so significant with Bentham's question in the history of animal rights and philosophy?
Yes, Bentham takes up a concern that was expressed in antiquity by several philosophers, including Plutarch and Porphyry, about the idea that it may not be the case that in order for an animal or for a being to have moral significance, that it has to possess what the ancient thinkers called logos, which is symbolic language or abstract rationality. And Bentham is trying to do something that Plutarch and Porphyry tried to do, which is try to sort of reproblematize the question of who counts as a morally significant being by shifting the focus away from logos, because there are lots of animals that don't seem to be able to speak at least human language and that may not have abstract rationality. And what he ends up saying in the introduction to the Principles of Moral Legislation is the question is not can they reason or can they talk, but can they suffer? So he seems to want to make a shift away from qualities such as, or capacities such as, language and reason, which people tend to think of as distinctively human, and to broaden the scope of moral concern to suffering so that it would include any sentient creature, any being that's capable of experiencing pleasure or pain.
But at the same time, you claim that Bentham falls short on the question of animal suffering. It seems that philosophers such as Peter Singer, Tom Reagan, remain within the same humanist framework that Bentham was caught in, which you say does a disservice to animals. So what exactly, what is it about this humanist framework that they're engaged in that isn't so helpful to the cause of animals exactly?
Yeah, what this humanist framework has done historically is privilege human beings. And to use Reagan's language, the humanist framework has tended to privilege moral agents and exclude the kinds of beings that Reagan calls moral patients. And moral patients for Reagan are infants, young children, human beings with severe mental disabilities, and any kind of sentient being that doesn't have language and rationality. And this humanist framework is something that entangles even people such as Bentham, Singer, and Reagan, all of whom ultimately, in spite of the fact that they appeal to a richer set of experiential capacities than reason or language, all three of these thinkers, like a long line of Western philosophers, end up nonetheless privileging human beings over animals. And so Tom Reagan says, for example, it would make sense to sacrifice the lives of a million dogs to save the life of one human being. And Peter Singer says, even though, as you note, he's thought of as the father of the modern animal rights movement, Singer doesn't, as a utilitarian, doesn't believe in rights. And he also believes, he says in Animal Liberation, that he thinks that animals can be treated as what he calls replaceable resources. Why? For the same reason that Bentham thought it was okay ultimately to kill animals, that they can't contemplate the future, they can't, and therefore they don't really have anything to lose by dying, or at least they have much less to lose than a human being does. So Bentham says, in the same passage where he says the real question is can they suffer, he also says it's perfectly okay to kill and eat animals because they're better off for dying at our hands than they would be for dying out in wild nature. And Singer says something comparable, which is if you treat the animals nicely until you kill them, and you kill them quickly and painlessly without stress, there's nothing wrong with it. And Reagan, as I said, ultimately privileges human beings over animals to such an extent that, on his reasoning, you could sacrifice the life of every non-human animal on Earth just in order to save one human being. Those are all based on humanist commitments, and the central humanist commitment is that somehow human beings possess capacities, and I really think it goes back to the Aristotelian criteria of logos, of reason or language, that because we possess those capacities, our lives are somehow more important, more morally significant in the cosmic scheme of things than those of non-human animals. So that's the problem of humanism, and the debate today between postmodernists and people like me is, what do we do about that? Do we retreat altogether from humanism, or can it be rehabilitated?
So let's touch on that term right there, postmodernism. So, of course, like you just said, the failures and the obsessive compulsion, you could almost say, of humanist thinkers on cognition and logos has led to some writers who would be labeled under the postmodernist umbrella to, of course, reject humanism. So what exactly do you mean by postmodernism, given that sometimes it's often used to group a different number of philosophical or philosophers together under one group who already have a diverse theories and diverse number of strands in their thought?
It's true. There is a philosopher who I believe is at the New School named Richard Bernstein who said something very interesting about postmodernism, which is that it's not really one set of commitments. It's a kind of ethos, and it's what he calls a protean and shifting ethos. But there are certain commitments that tie different postmodern approaches together, whether they're phenomenological or structuralist or post-structuralist or post-humanist, to use Kerry Wolf's term. And what they tend to have in common are these things. Number one, I think they want to privilege or assert the sort of irreducible complexity and multiplicity of phenomena in the world. And they want to say or pose a challenge to traditional philosophical pretensions to some kind of trans-historical, timeless, objective knowledge or insight about this infinite multiplicity of phenomena. So the basic move of all postmodern philosophers in one way or another is to try to argue that this existence or the reality of a kind of infinitely rich and diverse environment that surrounds us undermines our pretensions, our claims to have any kind of determinate, stable, enduring insight into the nature of that reality. And when I think about postmodern thinkers, in the book that you mentioned, Animals and Limits of Postmodernism, I'm really thinking about the post-structuralism of Derrida, and I guess we'll talk a little bit about this shortly, but I also think of thinkers such as Heidegger and Foucault. Lacan is a kind of a postmodern thinker, and in more recent discourse you have people like Judith Butler and Kerry Wolf and Leonard Lawler and Matthew Colarco. So I'm focusing primarily on what I take to be a kind of very influential approach within postmodernism, this post-structuralist approach that was really championed by Derrida. And I'm trying to show that even though there are thinkers in uh, that that post-structuralist tradition of thought who were expressing great concern for animals, there are fundamental problems with that post-structuralist approach that make it impossible to assert anything like moral obligations toward animals or toward other human beings.
So let's actually talk about Jacques Derrida for a second.
Sure.
Then. So you find Derrida's ideas, and I quote here from Derrida, that the conviction that abstract principles, this is a quote from you actually, that what Derrida seems to believe is that the conviction that abstract principles are simply tools for the suppression of difference. And you find this belief within postmodernist thought, which is of course emblematic within Derrida, you find this problematic. Can you explain why this exactly, this thought that the irreducible multiplicity of phenomena, the fact that experiences are so diverse and so different, and that we cannot have abstract principles, you find this so problematic for the cause of animals? Why is that exactly?
Yeah, what I see in Derrida in particular, and I focus on him, one could ask the question as a preliminary, if there's so many different approaches within postmodernism, why do I focus on Derrida in the book? And the answer is because, notwithstanding my severe criticism of this post-structuralist approach to understanding animals and philosophy and experience generally, I nonetheless think that Derrida's approach does a better job of any other postmodern approach I've encountered of doing some kind of justice or getting somewhat closer than the tradition has done to appreciating the richness and the significance of animal life. The problem that I see is this, that the terms of post-structuralism, and I developed this argument at pretty great length in the book, that the terms of post-structuralism place emphasis on the notion of the singularity, which means the irreducible uniqueness of individual moments or individual phenomena or individual beings. And to say that they're singular, and this is a language that you see in Derrida and other people who write in the post-structuralist tradition, means they're absolutely incommensurable with each other. And to say that they're absolutely incommensurable with each other means, and Derrida coins this term animaux, A-N-I-M-O-T, to try to sort of get around the problem of the term animal, which reduces, he says, all the rich multiplicity of animal life to one category of the animal. And he says there are many types of animals, and there's ultimately as many manifestations of animality as there are individual phenomena. So even what we call an animal, like my cat Pindar, is really this infinite, irreducible multiplicity of phenomena. Now, if they're really irreducible, and if they're really incommensurable to each other, then what that is predicated on is a denial that there's any stepping back and using any kind of rational, abstract insight to understand the nature of these phenomena, how they're connected with each other, what they are, what they signify. And what I argue in the book is that this emphasis on singularity of individual moments, where an individual instant is completely unlike and incommensurable and irreducible to any other, makes it impossible to articulate anything like a principle or a duty or an imperative with regard to it, and that moreover, this whole emphasis on singularity is derived from the thought of Friedrich Nietzsche, who has what is ultimately what I could only call a polemical conception of discourse. In other words, discourses don't describe things. Discourses proclaim or make claims in a forceful manner in an attempt to exercise control over other discourses. So that to say that discourse is polemical, if you think about the Greek term polemos, it means war, to speak is to fight. And this is no longer an attempt to achieve mutual understanding or any kind of peaceful interrelationships. Discourse is warfare. And I think that to start from a standpoint that has those two commitments, that everything is irreducibly singular, and from the standpoint that says that discourse is essentially polemical, that it's that all discourses are power struggles, I what I argue in the book is that I don't see any way to arrive even at the simple principle that peace is to be preferred to violence. Now, I've had many, many postmodern thinkers scoff at that suggestion, but I think if you really trace out the logic of the post-structuralist idea, if this particular instant in which I'm acting is absolutely incommensurable with any other one, then I'm basically like Kierkegaard's Abraham when I go to take Isaac up to Mount Moriah to kill him. To everybody else, it would be murder, but to me, it's just a singular event that's totally incommensurable with any other event. And if you model ethical decision, as Derrida does, on the notion of the irreducible singular choice that Abraham has, you can justify absolutely anything.
So of
that's
course,
the problem I see.
So of course, a big part of this is, like you said, the rejection and disavowal of principles that seek to connect these irreducible multiplicities to actually seek to kind of make guidelines within this. And of course, a big part of what you speak about when you actually talk about Derrida is that Derrida, of course, he himself says he doesn't believe in absolute vegetarianism because it cannot be done without a compromise. But I want to give a certain scenario, of course, that fits within kind of the post-structuralist motif. So for instance, if we're going to take, let's say, quinoa, for example. So the New York Times reports that because quinoa prices have almost tripled over the past 5 years, in, of course, North America and in Europe, chronic malnutrition in children has climbed in quinoa-growing areas due to climbing quinoa prices and more quinoa being destined for export. Or similarly, you can think of the same thing for tomatoes. We don't have currently in production such a thing as fair trade tomatoes. So when I buy tomatoes, that means I contribute to the exploitation of workers and families in Mexico, just like when I buy quinoa, I contribute to increasing prices and malnutrition.
Quinoa is a grain, because I know a lot of people don't know that.
Right. Thanks. So, of course, it seems to be when I make this choice to buy quinoa, for instance, or to buy tomatoes, and thus hurt the Mexican farmer or to hurt the people in Bolivia and not the animal, I'm making a compromise, right? And the opposite side of this compromise is eating locally raised beef that is also slaughtered locally. Yeah. So is that, could we not actually interpret this as the kind of the thing that Derrida speaks of when he says that we cannot be absolute vegetarians, because to be an absolute vegetarian would almost hierarchize animals above all other people, and as opposed to the fact that we have to live with violence continuously in our daily lives, and so we have to make these arbitrary choices at some point whether we want to value animals at a certain instance or value humans versus the Mexican worker versus the cow.
Yeah, so this is a really excellent way to focus what Derrida is trying to say. And I think as a defense of this idea of a compromise, I think it's a good one. I don't want to say that everything that Derrida says is wrong, but what I think is that the right things he says, like the fact that vegetarianism or veganism or ethics involves all kinds of compromises, is not an insight to which he has ownership. And I think it's something that it's almost a commonplace in ethics that there are always going to be ethical dilemmas, and I don't think that saying that animals have the right not to be killed and eaten by human beings, or to be, you know, otherwise used or exploited by human beings, means that it's going to be simple to implement that principle. And that's one of the things I argue in the book, is that the implementation of principles is something that, when it's done right, is very, very complicated, because you have to bring individual particular situations under a rule or under a general principle. And I don't think that there's any kind of life outcome, this is something I learned from Schopenhauer, that's going to be completely clean in the sense that nobody gets hurt. Okay, now that being said, the second thing that's worth saying is I think this whole constellation of problems that we're talking about resolves itself into three areas. There are human health and welfare issues, there are ecological issues, and there are animal rights issues. And they sit in a very uneasy tension with one another, and I don't think anybody has the faintest idea of how these are to be brought into relation with one another. I focus personally primarily on the animal rights question, and the reason I do that is because of the shocking number reported by the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization that every year worldwide 53 billion land animals are killed and consumed by human beings. It doesn't even count any fish or other sea creatures. It's a staggering, staggering number. And I see very, very little being done on behalf of these animals. So I don't want to say that animals are more important, say, than the Mexican farmer or anything like that. But what I want to say is this. If we're going to seriously consider the alternative to hurting the Mexican farmer to be killing locally raised beef, and I mean this only as a provocation, I don't mean it literally, why don't we raise and kill and consume some human beings? In other words, why will nobody ask that question? Why should we assume, or why should we even consider realistically the possibility that it might be better to kill and consume animals than to place some kind of economic hardship on a human being? And I simply want to raise the question, because the assumption that we ought to consider the possibility of eating locally farmed beef, you know, it assumes something that the humanist tradition assumes, which is that naturally human beings are morally more significant than non-human animals, and that's the thing that I really want to challenge. In the large frame of my work in the three books on animals that I've written, the argument that I've tried to make is that from a cosmic standpoint, human beings and animals should be considered to be morally equivalent to one another. There's no way you can privilege one morally over the other. Now, pragmatically, you might. You might pragmatically decide, I want to help out people in certain communities, and therefore I'm going to sacrifice animals. But that's an instrumental decision, a pragmatic decision. I don't see it as a moral one.
I guess that does make a lot of sense. So it seems to be very quickly, you're making a distinction between placing an economic hardship on somebody and the, let's say, the oppression and the violence that commits and the violence that is ending a life. You think there's a fundamental distinction between those two things?
Well, I do, and I don't think either of them is good, but I think that the killing question is a very, very significant one. And my friend and colleague Gary Francione has written extensively on animal rights and animal law, keeps bringing the discussion back to the killing question, that that's the thing that we don't seem to be willing to take seriously, is, you know, if there's something to me a little blithe in the idea that, well, maybe it's better just to eat locally farmed animals than it is to put people in remote parts of the world in economic distress. I'm not at all trying to belittle the economic distress that people in developing nations are in, but the killing question is massive to me, and I think that we ought to really try to think about, look, if there's one thing that post-structuralism does that I think is good, it's the same thing that Plutarch and Porphyry do, which is it gets us to think more seriously about the idea that animals care about their lives every bit as much as we care about our own lives, even if they can't conceptualize that sense of caring or life or ethics. And in that respect, I think that the death of an animal is every bit as significant as the death of a human being. And that's why I keep wanting to steer the discussion in that direction.
Great. Thanks so much, Gary.
My pleasure.
Fantastic discussion. Thank you for having being with us.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. You've been listening to the Animal Voices radio show on 102.7 FM Co-op Radio in Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada. Next week on the show, we'll be presenting a segment on animal activism, veganism, and spirituality. And we here at the Animal Voices show modestly ask you to keep connected with Animal Voices via the World Wide Web. You can do so by signing up on our Facebook page, Animal Voices Vancouver, or send us an email at radioanimalvoices@gmail.com. We're also at animalvoices.org. We are leaving you with a song that is by the band called Oi Puloi, and it's apparently a vegan recipe is what the song is. It's called Anarcho Pie. Thank you for tuning in. Stay tuned for Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith. Thanks so much for listening to Animal Voices today, and remember to be kind to the animals.
Tasty! Mixed page! Red beans! Goodness! Walnuts! Cashews! Tomatoes! Mushrooms! Let's make it tasty, and I come by! I see your food for you and I! Let's make it tasty, and I come by! I
see
a food for you and I.
Take 8 ounces of pastry and leave a little bit aside for all of 2 proportions, each a quarter inch thick. Then use one of these to carefully line the bottom of your chosen pie dish.
Let's make it tasty, but I can't pie. I see a food for you and I. Let's make it tasty, but I can't pie. I see a food for you and I.
Put the ingredients in the pie filling separately, and then place it inside the pie dish on top of the pastry base. Put in the top of the edge of the pastry base a bit of pastry cover to your Anarcho pie.
Now comes the important bit. Using the spare bits of pastry, decorate the top of the pie with a pastry anarchy sign, symbolizing our never-ending resistance to the homicidal system that perverts our lives.